conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own my special interest.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today's program, we cover several important topics. The first segment of the show, we're joined by scholars Anthony DiMaggio and Andrew Austin. We'll be talking about why Black Lives Matter won't be going away anytime soon. We'll discuss structural racism, the media, and our political campaigns. Later in the program, we'll discuss National Whistleblower Summit that's being held in Washington, D.C., July 27 to 29. We're joined by Government Accountability Project Legal Director Tom Devine and one of the summit organizers, Marcel Reed. Finally, we conclude with our own Peter Phillips talking about the Bohemian Grove meeting in Sonoma County. Stay with us.
Unthinkable crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, skies, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fought for little poison. The weapons manufactured paid for by attacks on the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons filled with capacity.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, for the first segment, we're talking about Black Lives Matter. We're talking about race in America. We'll be talking a little bit more also about media coverage of these issues. And we're joined by two professors that have recently written pieces on these issues. We're joined by Anthony DiMaggio, who was author of a piece at Counterpunch called Why Black Lives Matter Won't Go Away, a primer on systemic racism in America. And we're also joined by Andrew Austin, who wrote a piece on Truthout, changing the subject from the realities of death by cop. And here is Peter Phillips to introduce our guests today. Peter?
Anthony DiMaggio earned his Ph.D. in political science from the University of Illinois, Chicago. He's authored numerous books, including Mass Media, Mass Propaganda, back in 2008. His most recent one is Selling War, Selling Hope in 2015, and The Rise of the Tea Party in 2011. Welcome, Anthony.
Thank you for having me on.
It's great to have you. Also joining us today is Andrew Austin. He's an associate professor and chair of the Democracy and Justice Studies and Sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. He teaches classes in sociology of law with social justice emphasis, interested in crime, justice issues, political economy, political sociology, and race and ethnic relations. Welcome, Andrew.
Glad to be here.
Andrew, let's start with you. You wrote an essay in Truthout entitled Changing the Subject from the Realities of Death by Cop, and you were challenging Heather McDonald, who had written in the Wall Street Journal that fatal police shootings make up a much larger proportion of white and Hispanic homicide deaths than black homicides. Could you talk about that?
Sure. And let me, just to frame this, give you a little bit of background about Heather McDonald for people who don't know who she is. She's a fellow at the Manhattan Institute, which portrays itself as a libertarian think tank. And she's touted in conservative circles as an intellectual, not sort of one of the red meat bomb-throwing types. And so I think her work is particularly important to confront because it's portrayed as ideologically free, sober, rational. In June, she published a book, The War on Cops, which claims that there's this effect she calls the Ferguson effect, which explains why violent crime has been going up in urban areas, because the police have been intimidated sufficiently to back off their proactive stance, or what we refer to sometimes as broken windows thesis. It's fairly debunked thesis at this point, but the argument is that cops need to confront particularly minority youth in urban areas in order to get control over the population and keep crime down. I think the problem with her book and why she wrote this op-ed is that if police are backing off of aggressive policing and there aren't as many confrontations between the police and civilians, then why does it appear that police killings of civilians are on the rise in the context of a historic decline in crime and violence that we've seen over the past 40 years? And so I think that this op-ed that she wrote is an attempt to rationalize the problem with that thesis. And she does several things, but I think two things that really strike me. One is her conflation of whites with Hispanics, and I'm using the terms that she uses here, something that the Justice Department and the Bureau of Prisons did several years ago in trying to downplay the disproportionality of African Americans in prison. So she winds up, even after doing that, actually arguing against her own conclusion, because the facts do support that African Americans are killed by cops at a greater rate. And the data she's using is from the Washington Post. So that's the first mistake that she uses. Then she shifts to this black-on-black crime, right, that why don't we focus on the real problem, which is black-on-black crime? And this is a common refrain that you hear after every high-profile shooting by police officers, and it really is a red herring. It's a completely different subject. And so what I do in my piece is I break down the fallacies that she's using in that piece, both the conflation of ethnic categories as well as this diversionary tactic of black-on-black crime.
Anthony DiMaggio, let's bring you in and sort of merge this discussion. Your piece, Why Black Lives Matter Won't Go Away, A Primer on Systemic Racism in America, is a very important series of historical reminders. So could you merge in here and talk about the connection of why Black Lives Matter won't go away? Let's just use your own title.
I think that the main theme is to try and tie together different research that's been done in criminology studies, sociology, political science, looking at how we have this mountain of evidence that people really aren't treated the same in terms of institutions and society. So this is a big thing I talk about with my students when we cover the issue of civil rights. I mean, it's a huge part of political science and American government. And this concept of structural racism is a big one, that the way our society is structured, people are not treated equally based on race. So basically what I do in the piece is I look at things like studies on police brutality incidents, comparing, you know, whites versus blacks, racial profiling in terms of traffic stops, the way that the death penalty is implemented, the way that media coverage deals with issues like poverty and crime, and how these things are heavily racialized to create all types of stereotypes against minorities. And I particularly look at public attitudes as well, which is really the big outcome related to media studies, because people end up accepting these stereotypes and they don't end up being able to recognize that there is something called structural racism out there, that these institutions don't treat each other equally. So it's an important way to look at the issue of race and inequality. I think, unfortunately, a lot of people just look at race and racism as if it's interpersonal, but it's also a systemic thing, and that was what I was interested in covering.
Anthony, what are some of the stereotypes that the corporate media continues to reinforce in the white American public mind?
Well, I guess we could use the example of Heather McDonald. She was recently published in the Wall Street Journal, and she was on Rush Limbaugh. I listen to that show for sociological purposes only when I drive to teach. And it's interesting to see some of the comments that she's made. I mean, sometimes it's more blatant, sometimes it's less blatant. On a show like a Rush Limbaugh, people like Heather McDonald, I hate to be this crass, but it seems like she has one basic, simple message when you cut through all the statistics she's going through, and that's that African Americans equals bad. I mean, whether it be related to black-on-black crime or black-on-police crime. And if you take a look at some of the more blatant things that she's saying, it's not entirely clear that these things are even accurate. So I would agree, you know, that the point just being made that a lot of these statistics are used very selectively. I can give you some examples of it from my piece. So she talks in the Limbaugh program about alleged war on cops. I'm not sure I even accept the entire premise. It's pretty clear if you look at studies of police officers who've been killed in the last few decades, going back to President Ronald Reagan, we've seen about a 39% decline in police deaths since the Reagan administration. So that's sort of a big deal when you have a basic premise of your book and your argument, which isn't even apparently accurate. She also says in that interview, in my experience, cops are colorblind. She says those words, and I mean, that's really blatantly contradicted by a lot of the studies that we have about racial profiling and police brutality, which I cover in detail in my piece. So there's all types of questions here. One big thing that comes up in some of her writings and some of her comments is that, well, if you look at higher crime rates in minority and poor communities, how do we explain that? Is it explained historically because of higher amounts of poverty? This idea that's pretty common in sociology that, you know, desperation and poverty causes people to do desperate and violent things. And she really doesn't want to recognize that point whatsoever. And this is sort of, for lack of a better term, I would say, Bush League statistics. She says, well, how about in the 1960s? You know, in the 1960s, you had a really strong economy. Crime rates were much higher, presumably proving there's no link between economics and crime, which is really a horrible misreading of the entire situation, because if anybody knows anything about the 1960s and the war on poverty, you know, the poverty rate was much higher in the 1960s than it is in subsequent decades. And if you actually go to real studies of the relationship between poverty and violence, for example, if you look at the Bureau of Justice statistics, they're pretty clear that people who are poor in the lowest income category in America are twice as likely to be subject to violence than people who are in the highest income categories. So I would agree, you know, that we've got some problems here statistically in terms of some of the more blatant coverage. You know, when I say blatant, this idea of the Rush Limbaugh sort of in your face.
Dog whistle politics is what happens. We're seeing at these conventions and so forth, right? There's often on a show like Limbaugh, maybe it's perhaps less coded, more outright. But certainly in the book and Andrew Austin, you're talking about Heather McDonald in your piece. There is a sense that she's trying to dress up a particular argument, but then you say that she actually contradicts it.
Right, because she uses a database which shows that African Americans are more than two times as likely as any other group. In fact, including her lumped group of whites and Hispanics, which includes non-white Hispanics, they're still more than two times more likely to be the victim of a police shooting. But she draws the opposite conclusion from the data that she uses. It's a very interesting rhetorical twist that she uses in the piece. She's clever, but the statistics don't support her argument.
That's pretty remarkable.
Andrew Austin, you teach at the University of Wisconsin, and your work there focuses on ethnic relations. Now, one of the things that we're seeing from both of your pieces here is there's been a decline in police dying. I'm hearing 39% decline, and last year there were 40 officers killed, and only 16 of those were killed by black people. So proportionately, there's over 100 or thereabouts people dying monthly in this country by being killed by police, usually shot, but sometimes other killings happen. So it's incredibly disproportionate, for one, and it's also disproportionate in terms of race, for two, which is what you were both saying. And so talk about those trends. We're hearing about it more. So perhaps that's why Heather McDonald felt compelled to write this, because of cell phones and filming of these activities and media interest, so to speak, in police killings. But we've had these levels of killing now for decades, and they weren't covered. At Project Censored, we did research on law enforcement-related deaths, and we looked at the newspapers of the United States, and they were reporting several hundred a year, while the FBI was reporting 300 or 400. And then we have found out that a lot aren't even reported, now that we have the websites that list the number of killings, which are over 100 a month. So, Andrew, could you respond on that a little bit?
Well, I think, as best I can tell from the data, it's never been safer to be a cop in the United States, at least in the past 50 years. It has been a dramatic decline in the number of police fatalities. We're also in the middle of, despite the recent uptick in urban areas, we're in the middle of a historic decline. Both the Uniform Crime Report and the National Crime Victimization Survey show this decline since the 1990s. The National Crime Victimization Survey shows decline starting in the 1970s, and I think there's something to the success of the New Deal and the Great Society in building social support in communities. It's true that crime rates were high in the 60s. The poverty rates and inequality rates hadn't started to decline as dramatically as they would coming out in the 70s. Now they're starting to uptick. So we find ourselves in the context of a historic decline in crime. It isn't clear that mass incarceration is the cause of that, because we see this in Western societies everywhere, although they did not launch incarceration binges. And I think part of this is conservatives troubled by the conversation now about reforming the criminal justice system. Jeffrey Ryman pointed out about the function of the criminal justice system as an ideology which tells us who the bad people are. And if you reform the criminal justice system and you criticize it for the racialization of justice in this country, then conservatives begin to lose something that they've been desiring very much since the 1970s, right? Going back to the crisis of democracy and what they perceive as a failure failure of the population to respect authority, that the crisis of democracy is actually the problem with too much democracy and communities having too much power, having too much collective efficacy. So I think that's why we see so much attention being placed on violence. And I think that the fact that we have the videotapes now, that we can, you know, we're having things that we can point to very visibly, is bringing all this to a head. It's giving some tactile reality, if you will, to this conflict, which has been going on in the United States, as I'm sure all of you know, for hundreds of years, given what the function of the police have been historically.
Indeed. That's Andrew Austin. He's associate professor and chair of Democracy and Justice Studies and Sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. We are also joined today by Anthony DiMaggio, an author and political scientist. We're talking about a few recent pieces that these gentlemen wrote, and we will continue our discussion on race in America after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. For this segment of the program, we are joined by Anthony DiMaggio. He is a political scientist, and he is author of numerous books, including Mass Media, Mass Propaganda, When Media Goes to War, and The Rise of the Tea Party. Also, Anthony DiMaggio has contributed a chapter to one of the Project Censored books several years ago. We are also joined by Andrew Austin, professor and chair of Democracy and Justice Studies and Sociology at the University of Wisconsin in Green Bay. And before the break, Andrew Austin, you were talking about the longevity of the situation of racial tension and so forth in the United States and the long history of the purpose of the police. That was the note you ended on. And Anthony DiMaggio, let's go back to you. Recently on the Project Censored show, we interviewed historian Carol Anderson from Emory University about her new book, White Rage. And one of the concepts that came up in that book, something I mentioned a little bit ago, dog whistle politics, sort of coded ways of talking about things. And the corporate media in particular, they're very good at framing things in ways, right? And this kind of gets me to this other phrase, the title of the piece that you did not long ago, Why Black Lives Matter Won't Go Away. That also reminds us that in the corporate media, there's another phrase that often is used as sort of like a comeback to this called All Lives Matter. I like to say all lives matter, but some lives matter more than others, riffing on George Orwell. Let's talk about that as a part of framing in media.
I talk a bit in my piece about the ways in which a lot of the media coverage, much more subtly than, let's say, the Rush Limbaugh coverage I talked about earlier, much more subtly conveys stereotypes. And I think this happens on a number of levels. On one hand, we just have to understand that there's a hysteria over crime in America in general that's been really stoked by political elites and the media. We know during the 1990s and 2000s that the rate of violent crime in America was going down, while actual studies of news coverage suggested that the coverage was going way up. We've seen more recently that police killings have been going down for decades, and yet we're here talking about a war on cops, and that's been a dominant theme in the news. What I talk about in the piece is how this sort of a obsession or fixation, you could say, with crime, how it ends up getting linked, and issues like poverty, too, with race. Now, nobody in a nighttime newscast says we're going to traffic in stereotypes, so this is a disclaimer before we get started that we're racist, so understand we're going to do these things. But they just sort of do it. We know from studies that have been done, for example, that news reports tend to overrepresent African Americans as criminals. In other words, the percentage of African Americans who are shown as engaging in violent crime is much higher than the actual percentage of African Americans who commit violent crime. We know that white individuals, Caucasians, are more likely to be depicted as victims in much higher numbers than the actual number of victims. We know that this happens with poverty stories, too. African Americans are much more likely to be depicted as poor in stories compared to the actual number of African Americans who are poor. So what ends up happening, and this has been shown in numerous experimental studies in the field of political communication, that people get these very racialized, very racially charged notions in their head that to be criminal is to be black, to be a victim is to be white, to be poor is to be black. And this ends up spilling over into people's attitudes regarding things like welfare policies, with regards to crime policy. These experimental studies are really quite fascinating. They show that all you have to do is manipulate the picture, the image of somebody in a story about crime or poverty, make the person white versus black, and you get totally different outcomes, particularly among whites, when it comes to things like criticizing welfare as being abused, when it comes to this idea that you should lock people up and throw away the key, these very punitive anti-crime policies, three strikes and you're out, and so on. So these are things that are open secrets, basically. Political communication scholars have known these things for a long time now. I think the real problem is that, you know, this kind of stuff doesn't get talked about very much, and in a lot of these corporate media discussions that we're covering, they don't give much context to the broader patterns, and that's pretty obvious why, because they're complicit in it.
I remember studies even a decade ago that talked about the differences in black crime and white crime, and that it was more a matter of police arresting more people of color than white people, proportionately. That the crime rates, essentially, victims were reporting that they were essentially equal or proportionately. So this mythology continues to be perpetrated that blacks are more violent, increasingly more criminal, and are killing police. Both of you are saying that's just not true. Could you elaborate?
Well, I could add, if you look at uniform crime report statistics, which the media tends to use, they show that some 40% of individuals that are arrested for violent crime are African American. But if you look at the National Crime Victimization Survey, which has the benefit of actually being a scientifically constructed survey, you'll find that the top range of disproportionality is 22%. So roughly half the amount that the police report is reported according to victims. So the facts do support what you're saying there.
I want to go back a little bit again and emphasize more on media. And I know, Anthony DiMaggio, you talk about in your piece media discrimination, and you also talk about issues of public opinion. Do you want to elaborate on that a little bit more for folks?
Right. Related to public opinion, I mean, part of this you can see in experimental studies. When I mentioned there's a tie between media coverage and public opinion, you know, part of the problem there is that those are very limited studies. You're talking about an experiment which is not, strictly speaking, generalizable to the entire population because it's got a small sample of people. But what we do know, looking public opinion surveys nationally, is that one of the big problems that comes up with regards to issues like Black Lives Matter is whether people are actually willing to recognize that there is structural racism and structural discrimination related to things like racial profiling, police brutality, and so on. We know from the recent Pew Research Center survey done in the summer of 2016 that something like 30% of Americans think that there's no issue, you know, that our country, and this is the exact words, our country has made the changes needed to give blacks equal rights to whites. And that's just simply not accurate. There's really no excuse in a society like ours where people claim to be part of the greatest country in the world and the most democratic country in the world for people to be so ignorant about the things that we're talking about. What we know from a lot of these public opinion surveys is that there's a big difference between African Americans and whites in terms of willingness to recognize structural problems. Surveys that are done and look at African American perspectives, you see that a majority of African Americans surveyed say that if there are problems in black communities, they have to do with personal misbehavior, but also structural factors. So those surveys show that people talk about both of those things. What you notice with white people in these surveys, with white respondents, is that they want to attribute everything to personal behavior, but very rarely are people willing to recognize the structural factors. If you talk about things like depressed communities where there aren't enough well-paying jobs, underfunded schools, racial discrimination in general in society and from police, these are things that you oftentimes find in surveys less than half of white Americans are willing to even recognize, whereas much more than half of African Americans recognize these things. Large majorities do. So we have this real sort of disconnect here based on race in America. And there's been a lot of research on this in political science, this idea that being black in America versus being white and the way people get treated, they have totally different views, statistically speaking, about the role of police in society. That some have a much more charitable view, others not. And it's clearly related to how people are treated. But until you get to that point where public opinion recognizes this on a higher level, or more frequently people start recognizing this, I don't think we're going to have as much progress as we need to.
I think it also has to do with the way we talk about crime and what constitutes as crime. So people leave off of the word crime, street crime, and when you compare it to elite deviance, corporate theft, and violence, you actually find in total dollar amounts that street crime is swamped by just take employee theft alone. But then you have physician fraud, you have deaths of workers on the job. These things fit the definition, common law definition, of criminal actions, but they're not prosecuted, they're handled internally. They don't get reported to the police and therefore aren't reported out to the media. So the fact that the media focus on official sources rather than doing investigatory work and looking at corporate crime and violence excuse the perception that the public has about race, given that the poor and disproportionately minority are going to be overrepresented in street crime, whereas white affluent males are going to be overrepresented in what we call sweet crime.
That's the voice of Andrew Austin. He's a professor at the University of Wisconsin. Also on the air with us is Anthea DiMaggio, author and researcher and recent author of an article, Why Black Lives Matter. Part of the perpetuation of this, of course, is that people from Congress, Stephen King from Ohio, can overtly say on television, what have non-whites done for civilization? I mean, it was such a racist statement. It was somewhat called out by liberal press, but it was almost left there to be accepted by corporate media.
That was remarkable. And the host of the show, I'm blanking on his name right now, he did not allow the other panelists to contradict that statement. He dropped kind of an obligatory, well, you know, on our side of the ledger, we have Hitler and Stalin, which wasn't an argument for what the congressman said. That was outrageous, and that should have blown up the media. But you're right. It was quickly pushed to the side, and folks moved on.
Well, another issue here, again, that comes up, Anthony DiMaggio, in your piece, and we touched on it a little bit ago, when we talk about Black Lives Matter, one of the retorts is all lives matter, but now there's the rise of Blue Lives Matter. I'm not sure what a blue life is, but of course we do know what this is referring to.
I mean, I think it's a total non-starter as far as I can tell. I haven't encountered a single person ever who says that blue lives, he's talking about police, don't matter. I mean, these attacks on police are universally condemned in society. If there's somebody who's not condemned them or celebrated them, I'd like to see. I haven't seen any sort of documentation. So I think when you talk about the rise of these kinds of slogans, and that's what that is, it's sloganeering, I think it's intentionally diversionary. You're trying to direct attention away from the mountain of evidence that suggests that based on race, people are not treated equally in America. And if you can make it into something else, then the issues go away.
Andrew Austin, we're going to have to wrap up this segment, but your concluding commentary on that issue.
On the issue of Blue Lives Matter?
Yeah, when framing in general.
Yeah, I mean, I do see the Blue Lives Matter slogan being used. I'm a criminologist teaching in a law and justice studies program. We have a lot of correctional officers and police officers who come through our program. And so I get a lot of emails and a lot of Facebook things touting this Blue Lives Matter problem. It is a diversion. But we have to understand what the relationship is, that blue lives, police officers, are public officials of the state and have to be held to a very strict standard of professional conduct. And by saying blue lives matter, it's the same function as, you know, support our troops. It's designed to prevent the criticism of an institution, to prevent the criticism of policy, and to get people focused on the heroes, the boys and girls in uniform. Standard fare.
Yes, indeed. Anthony DiMaggio, your final thoughts.
I would say that this is a fascinating discussion in the sense that I'm thinking this conversation ties into the broader national election politics. I mean, as far as I can tell, this is really, for lack of a better term, a battle for sort of the soul of where America is going. You've got the Trump phenomenon and the clear xenophobia and racism that's been attached to it. And we're just going to have to see how it plays out in terms of the strong push through the Black Lives Matter movement. It's clear that different groups of Americans have very different priorities in terms of where they see this country going. My hope as someone who, you know, believes in equality and justice and democracy is that we can get to the point where people are treated equally. So obviously I'm not falling in the Trump camp here.
Anthony DiMaggio, you authored recently at Counterpunch, Why Black Lives Matter Won't Go Away, a primer on systemic racism in America. Thank you for joining the Project Censored program today. And Andrew Austin, author recently at Truthout of Changing the Subject from the Realities of Death by Cop. Thank you both, Andrew and Anthony, for joining our program today.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Please stay with us as after the musical break, we'll be talking about the National Whistleblower Summit in Washington, D.C. We'll be joined by Tom Devine and Marcel Reed.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic psychiatrists.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. In this segment of today's program, we're going to be focusing on whistleblowers and the Whistleblower Summit in Washington, D.C. We are joined by Marcel Reed. She is one of the longtime organizers of the Whistleblower Summit in Washington, D.C. And we're also joined today by Tom Devine. He is the legal director of the Government Accountability Project. GAP was founded in 1977. So we're going to be spending this segment of the show talking a lot about whistleblowers and updates on whistleblowers and also what goes on at this annual whistleblower summit in Washington, D.C., that has interface not only with whistleblowers, but also members of Congress, U.S. government. And so let's start with you, Marcel Reed. First of all, Marcel Reed and Tom Devine, thanks for joining us on the Project Censored Show again.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Marcel Reed, let's start with you. And a lot of people may not know that there is such a thing as the Whistleblower Summit, despite that this has been going on for some years. Project Censored has supported this and been a co-supporter of this. Tell folks about this.
Absolutely. This is the largest annual gathering, the only annual gathering of whistleblowers and their advocates in the U.S., perhaps the world to my knowledge. And we bring together both whistleblowers and advocates, members of the press, and the general public. And it's the only mix of people like that that we're aware of. We also bring in people who develop policy as well as lawmakers. And it's a very effective network for whistleblowers to have contact with the public as well as lawmakers. And it's also a support system for whistleblowers so that they don't feel so alone, because blowing the whistle very often isolates you.
Well, Marcel Reed, can you tell us a little bit more specifically what is going to be going on here? What goes on at the summit itself? What kind of activities? Who are some of the folks? And what are some of the subjects this year?
Every year we have panelists, and we have panels on various things that are in the news right now. For instance, this year we're going to have panelists that are going to be talking about LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, which will be a group of law enforcement officers retired who are going to talk about how the law has affected so many people. We're going to have people from law enforcement that are going to say that they were whistleblowers, and when they tried to report many of the things we're seeing reported in the news now, how they lost their jobs or were threatened. Some of them were actually threatened with being harmed on their jobs, as well as a cadre of panelists that are going to talk about things that affect people and the federal government specifically. This year's partners will also be hosting some panels. I know that GAP is going to host two panels, and I'm sure Tom can talk about those in depth, but those panels are going to be about the Office of Special Counsel. And we're also going to have a panel on healthcare in America. It's going to talk about how so many people have blown the whistle on healthcare, as well as the impact of whistleblowing directly on people in the community. We're going to have an EEOC panel where we're going to have members of the EEOC speak to people in the federal government as well as private industry about how those laws are affecting them. So it's a great opportunity to learn information, to mingle with other whistleblowers, to directly question policymakers. And we round that out by having an evening book signing and filming and the airing of a film that usually focuses on whistleblowers. That will be followed on Thursday by a reception that's being hosted by GAP, POGO, and Public Citizen. And that's an opportunity for the general public, members of the whistleblowing community, and staffers in Washington, D.C. to get together and just to meet each other and to hear the concerns that whistleblowers and members of the advocacy community have. It's well-rounded.
Yes, that is. Marcel Reed, you're a Pacifica Whistleblower Liaison. You're one of the organizers of the Whistleblower Summit in Washington, D.C. You can learn more at whistleblowersummit.com. And Tom Devine, Legal Director at Government Accountability Project, you're one of the sponsors and participants in the Whistleblower Summit. Talk to us a little bit about what GAP's doing at the summit.
We're leading two panels. One is about kind of the state of freedom of speech rights for whistleblowers, the successes and failures in the free speech campaigns we're working on. The other is a panel about the Federal Whistleblower Agency, the U.S. Office of Special Counsel, which is kind of the hub of the action for federal government whistleblowers. And that's going to include a couple of people who are really heroes to me on it. I like a lot of the special counsel officials, and they'll have some representatives, but I'm talking about the whistleblowers. One is a gentleman named Robert McClain. He's a federal air marshal who prevented a more ambitious rerun of 9/11 in 2003 when the air marshal service was about to go AWOL during the threat. It had been confirmed by U.S. counterintelligence after tips from Saudi intelligence that al-Qaeda was planning to have another strike, only this one would not just target the capital, but cities up and down the West Coast in the U.S., European capitals, London, Paris, Rome, the capital of Australia even, Canberra. And in the middle of this threat, the air marshals were going to cancel all of our coverage due to some bureaucratic scandals, kind of corruption going on there. And Mr. McLean warned the public that this was going to happen. He prevented the air marshals from going AWOL. He was fired for doing so. He fought his case all the way up to the Supreme Court and won last year with help from the U.S. Office of Special Counsel. The other whistleblower who will be on our panel, Mickey, is somebody else who's just really special. His name is Brandon Coleman. And Brandon ran the nation's most effective suicide prevention program for veterans at the Veterans Administration. It's saved so many lives there. But he lost a few because he was sort of an island of care in a sea of neglect. He would get people's hopes up and all charged up, and then they'd go and sit in an empty room for 6 hours, getting ignored and get desperate and walk out in the middle of traffic and kill themselves. So he blew the whistle on the lack of support surrounding his work. And the VA responded by canceling the whole suicide program and trying to fire him. And through the Office of Special Counsel, he not only got his job back, but the suicide program has been expanded. And they'll both be telling their stories.
Tom and Marcel, I'm looking at the schedule for the events, and this is happening in Washington, D.C. on the 27th, 29th of July. One of the days, it looks like Thursday, you're going to have a panel moderated by Andrew Krieg on the 28 pages, and that has been finally declassified as part of the 9/11 report, which identifies key Saudi personnel, government officials, and closely related, who were in support and helped provide money for and logistics for some of the alleged 9/11 hijackers. Do you see that as a major release, an important event?
It's one that's actually whistleblowers have been pushing for a long time. And at last year's summit, a gentleman named Bill Bergman spotlighting the need for that and more thorough investigations. Bill had been working at Federal Reserve Board when 9/11 happened, and he discovered that there had been a tremendous, striking, unprecedented withdrawal of funds by Saudis from U.S. banks right before 9/11. And he started asking some questions. What was going on here? And do we know the explanation? And he was immediately fired just for asking the questions. And we're hopeful that his long campaign to get the truth out will be reinforced by this development that we can thank former Senator Graham for.
Marcel Reed, there are several excellent panels, topics, discussions. One, Black and Blue, Black Lives Matter and Police Whistleblowers, among others. What can you tell us about that?
Thank you for asking. It was a recently added panel. We were going to have a panel that didn't confront this so directly. But the reason that we impaneled this is one of our whistleblower participants, Matthew Fogg, is a former U.S. Marshal. And he is very immersed in the law enforcement world, along with Mr. Grogan, who is also a former U.S. Marshal. They, for years, have talked about what has been going on in the law enforcement arena, the disparity in treatment, and the fact that when any of them spoke up, just asking the question very often will derail your career. This was an opportunity for them to now gather on Capitol Hill and talk about specifically what they have been seeing. And not just what they've been seeing and reporting out what's wrong, but hopefully to try to cobble together some cures for it, some way to fix this problem that's been ongoing. I mean, I remember distinctly hearing about this for the last 20 years. Some version of this is always cropping up every 12 to 18 months. There weren't video cameras before, but the stories in many instances were absolutely true and absolutely ignored. We hope that this will be an opportunity for that. And one of our media panel participants, a woman named Diane Andrews, is currently in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, where she has a program called In Black and White. She has interviewed everyone associated with the shooting in Baton Rouge. One of her associates was actually there when the officers were shot in Baton Rouge. They were actually there and had the policemen have them turn their car around once they realized what was happening. So that would be an opportunity for someone to report out who was actually at the scene of it and who saw what was happening, as well as knowing all of the members of the man's family who was shot. So we hope that this will be an opportunity for people to speak back and forth about this while there are policymakers in the room. Hopefully staffers from Capitol Hill will be there. So we'll be more than just demonstrating in the street. We will be in the room with people who can make some significant changes.
That's the voice of Marcel Reed. She is one of the organizers of the Whistleblower Summit in Washington, D.C. You can learn more at whistleblowersummit.com. We are also joined by legal director of the Government Accountability Project, GAP. You can learn more about them at whistleblower.org. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. You're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. We'll be back after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. In this segment of the program today, we're talking about whistleblowers and the National Annual Whistleblower Summit in Washington, D.C. We're joined by Legal Director of Government Accountability Project, Tom Devine, also by one of the summit organizers, Marcel Reed. You can learn more about that summit at whistleblowersummit.com. You can learn more about GAP at whistleblower.org. Tom Devine, let's go to you. Talk to us a little bit about the general state of whistleblowing and whistleblower protection in the U.S. today.
At the risk of being a plagiarist like Melania Trump, it's been the best of times and the worst of times for whistleblowers. The good news is that this continues to probably be the only significant issue in Congress with consistent, bipartisan, unanimous political support. And that's just got to be optimistic for those of us who are challenging abuses by the power structure. We seem to have the politicians on our side. And that's evidenced by two whistleblower caucuses that have developed since last year. In fact, we're on the verge of having complete makeovers of the Military Whistleblower Protection Act, the FBI whistleblower rights, the whistleblower rights for VA employers, making permanent best practice contractor whistleblower rights after a four-year experiment. And this is all during the all-Republican Congress when neither party can get anything done. So we're kind of excited. That's good news. The bad news, first of all, there's an all-encompassing national security loophole that, ironically, both the Bush and Obama administrations shoved through and got judicial approval for that could cancel all the free speech rights that we've gotten for federal workers. A second thing is that the whistleblower agencies are getting the same treatment as the Supreme Court nominees. They're not filling the vacancies, and we might have to depend on Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, really neither, whom our community trusts, to be staffing the people who implement and enforce these rights. The third thing is that we've learned that at the whistleblower agencies, it's very dangerous to back the whistleblowers. My docket is getting dominated now by investigators who are backing whistleblowers and then getting retaliated against because they didn't try to team up and finish them off and tank their rights. It's very dangerous to be responsible to protect whistleblowers. And further, we've got the Department of Labor. We've got a legal challenge by the judges there that could set back whistleblower rights more than 40 years in terms of how the laws Congress passed are interpreted. Mickey, this is a timeless struggle. And I bet if we talk next year, it'll be the best and the worst of times again.
Marcel, I'm seeing also in your program here statement or exposures about violent, racist, neo-Nazi skinheads infiltrating the military and the police forces in the U.S. Could you expand a little bit on that?
Yes. We have law enforcement officers who said at our last two summits that there has been a targeted effort for these people to infiltrate police departments throughout the country, and that when they have reported it, instead of the report being taken a look at, instead they have found themselves isolated and often ousted from these police departments. We hope to bring this up at this summit so that people will start to hear this and connected with some of the shootings that have gone on recently and the attitude that these policemen have been telling us for the longest time. I believe ever since Serpico, there has been a consistent attempt to report corruption within police departments, and they have always met with retaliation.
That's Marcelle Reed. She is one of the organizers of the Whistleblower Summit for Civil and Human Rights, taking place in Washington, D.C., July 27, 29. You can learn more at whistleblowersummit.com. We've also been joined by the legal director of the Government Accountability Project. You can learn more about GAP at whistleblower.org. That's all the time we have for this segment today. So Tom Devine, Marcelle Reed, thank you both for the work you do for whistleblowers and raising awareness around whistleblowers. Project Censored, of course, is continuing proud co-sponsor of the Whistleblower Summit. Thank you both for your work and for joining us again on the Project Censored show today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And now for the final segment, we'll hear from our own Peter Phillips, who is a scholar, talking about the global elites and power elites that are meeting in Sonoma County every summer in July at what's called Bohemian Grove. So here's Peter Phillips to talk a little bit about that.
We want to remind all our listeners that the Bohemian Club is in session right now up in Monte Rio in the Redwoods, and that's several hundred or 2,000 to 3,000 on the weekend. Mostly white males are frolicking in the woods. They burned care. They had their cremation of care ceremony, so they're out there just playing, drinking, carrying on, and having a great good time. So we want to acknowledge that the 1% is out there, and we would like them to be more careful about what's going on in the world and to really think about the possibilities of war from either of our presidential candidates and the unrest and the environment and a variety of other concerns that we're facing in the world today. Please, Mr. Bohemians, it's time to really care about the world and what's going on.
Well, Peter, you've done a lot of research on not just the 1% and global elites and so forth, but you also did your dissertation on the Bohemian Club in San Francisco, and you've actually been to this Bohemian Grove in Sonoma County. Again, you've done research here. And so what exactly are these people doing there right now?
Well, they're essentially celebrating themselves.
And who are these people?
Well, they're one out of five is somebody really, really powerful in the country. Runs a major corporation, high government officials, or you know, serving on a major policy board in some capacity. And four or five are ordinary rich people, mostly from the Bay Area, but a lot from L.A. and just about every state in the country, and a few people from other countries.
And including major political operators, potentially?
All constantly there. I mean, there's obviously going to be people from Trump's campaign that are going to be there and handshaking and involved, certainly some people from Hillary's campaign. But, you know, that's secondary. It's all about being in the right place at the right time, celebrating yourself, lots of music, lots of alcohol, having a good time.
So this isn't about any grand conspiracy per se, but obviously when these power brokers, these influential people, when they get together, it's not a stretch to suggest that they talk about their interests, their ideas, their what they might be planning to do over the next year, business mergers, whatever.
Of course, they get together, you know, if they're on the same board of directors, they're going to talk about policies. If they're two companies that are interested in perhaps merging or something, they'll go aside. They won't do it overtly that everybody can hear. They'll sit aside somewhere under a big redwood tree and kind of hash it out, just like Nixon and Reagan agreed who was going to run for president going back 40 years now or so. But they sat there under the trees and had a conversation about that. So it's a networking place where very important people hang out. And this idea that they don't care about the world, they burn the cares of the world, they come there in the comradeship of being friends with each other in the spirit of Bohemia, is somewhat misleading in that that's not the spirit of who they are. They're very much part of the global elite, the power policies, and we're asking them to care a little bit more.
Yeah, and you've been inside as an invited guest. I mean, so the idea that, you know, of course, the infamous story of Alex Jones saying he has to sneak in and talk about crazy things that these people are doing there. You've actually been in the Bohemian Grove. Yeah,
Alex Jones exaggerated. It was that was beyond the pale. You don't need to say that kind of stuff because these are very powerful people that will leave here having a consensus of understanding of what their friends and other associates want to see happen in the world, and they'll go off to the Council of Foreign Relations or the Trilateral Commission or the Bilderberger Group and have some say in terms of what's going on in the world today.
And these people are meeting right now in Sonoma County at Bohemian Grove.
They are playing right now at Bohemian Grove in Sonoma County and somewhat frolicking in the redwoods and peeing on redwood trees very overtly. And having a good time.
Well, if you want to learn more about the transnational capital class and more of the power elites, you should check out some of Peter Phillips' work at projectcensored.org. In the last several Censored books, he's had chapters on a lot of what these people are doing. So, Peter, thanks for sharing an update on the Bohemian Grove.
All righty.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came.
Thanks for joining the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio today. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. The Project Censored Show airs on 35 stations around the U.S., from Maui to New York. To learn more, go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. Special thanks to our producer, Anthony Fest, and our engineer, Erica Bridgman. We'll see you next time.
Political ties, habitualized, alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little poison. The weapons manufactured paid for by attacks on the prisons and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the ties for the master thief.